Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Sensei Margot Van Etten for their discussion on martial arts, spirituality, and the growing influence of women. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues for Martial Arts, Spirituality, and the Growing Influence of Women. It's my pleasure to invite my good friend, Sensei Margot Van Etten. Good to see you again.
Oh, it's good to see you.
We don't get together in any dojos anymore. But I know you and Kathleen and some other women senseis that I know are still practicing and mostly sword, some karate.
I'm practicing mostly karate right now because I don't have the space to practice sword. It's not really good to do in the house.
This is true. Well, let me just give a brief introduction for most of you don't know Sensei Margot. Margot truly has a wide and varied background in spirituality, as well as martial arts. So she holds several black belts in related forms of karate and Japanese sword arts. She was one of my teachers and Kathleen's teachers. She has studied and taught martial arts for almost 40 years through the Harp Karate Martial Arts Center in Rochester. And she also developed women's self-defense classes that she taught at local colleges and also at the Martial Arts Center. And I had fun a few years helping her with that. Kathleen did too. Her integrative interest led her to also develop an inner development class at the Martial Arts Center, and really connecting her interest in spirituality and inner states with how it flows through your body and in martial arts. She's been a lay minister in the Catholic Church for many years, holds a master's degree in sacred theology from St. Bernard's Institute in Rochester, and she was the campus minister and director of the Brockport Newman Center, which is the Catholic campus ministry for the College of Brockport, a SUNY college. Then she retired and began working as the pastoral minister for St. Monica's Church in Rochester and Emmanuel's Church of the Deaf, where she became the first woman who was not a nun to be named pastoral associate in the Diocese of Rochester. Before then, she was a sign language interpreter and liaison to the chaplain's office at the Rochester Institute of Technology. So during her time at Brockport, she was significantly involved in interfaith work with local ministers, student organizations, including the Muslim Student Association and campus ambassadors, interfaith campus ministry organizations across the Rochester area, and with the Diocese of Rochester's Catholic Orthodox Commission, exploring relationships with the Eastern Orthodox churches. And she says it fits neatly into her early background where she grew up in Long Island and had a diverse religious and cultural population where she grew to appreciate the Jewish tradition as well as her own Christian faith. Even more, she's been a lifelong student of meditation, spirituality, prayer, and mysticism. In addition to formal theological studies, including at the Colgate Rochester Divinity School in St. Bernard's, she studied Dzogchen meditation and Tibetan Buddhism with Lama Surya Das. She studied with Tony Packer, who was at the Zen Center in Rochester and later at Springwater Retreat Center. She's attended retreats in Zen, mindfulness meditation, centering prayer, and explored Native American and Celtic, primarily Christian spirituality. And she's currently a companion of the New Skeet Orthodox Monastic Community in Cambridge. So, how did you get interested in martial art?
Well, many years ago, I had been ill. I had developed a hypoglycemia and had kind of stepped back from ministry and the other things I was doing. And I had read several books about martial arts as moving meditation, which intrigued me. But I never thought of myself as very athletic or anything. However, my doctor had said that exercise would be a good thing to do, some formal exercise at this point. And I thought, well, this might be a chance to try it out. So I'd called around to several schools and I went to visit Harp Karate. And I knew it was the right place when I walked in the door. And in the entryway, there was this beautiful scroll, a Chinese scroll, one of those sort of mountainscapes where there's a path going up the mountain and it's all misty and everything, and an Afghan hound. And somehow this was so atypical of martial arts schools that I thought that was interesting. And so I took a class and enjoyed it. And so I started taking classes. The other thing is, it was the only one of the few schools that offered day classes, which is what had caused me to check it out to begin with. But you had the feeling that there was something more than just punching and kicking going on, even at that early stage. Over the course of a summer, I slowly got hooked.
Were there women in the class when you started?
No. There was a woman that was assisting Sensei Harp at the time running the school, and I met her. But the day class, which is what I attended at first, was all guys, most of them really tall, and most of them green or brown belts. I later found out, and I didn't find this out until I was like a fourth degree black belt, and he told me, Sensei Harp had called the guys into the room and threatened them with death if they scared me away. So they kind of reacted as if this wet kitten had washed up on the shore and they were taking care of me. It was great.
Well, that's interesting to know about that. Yeah. I learned after the fact when we started, it's interesting because when we started, if you remember, it was Kathleen's oldest son who wanted to take karate, and she hoped he would forget it when he got to
karate. I remember that.
Right. And he didn't. He recovered and decided he wanted to do it. And so we searched around, not a lot, but somebody had said, the only place to do this in Rochester is at Harp Karate. So we went and we thought he would sign him up for an introductory class. Nobody was at the class except him and the teacher, who said, why don't you all do it? So we did. And interesting enough, one class, I guess kind of like you, we fell in love with it. So Sensei Harpe told me after the fact that they had bets on how long I would last. I was so out of shape. Yeah, so I lasted 6 years, right? We all got black belts, if you remember. The kids got junior black belts because none of them were over 16 by the time they got their black belts. The other thing I liked about that school is when we were training for it, we were pretty close. We went as a family. And when we were going to test for our black belt, we had also heard that Sensei Harp said, the parents get it first. And I silently applauded and thanked him for saying that. Then we dropped out. You didn't drop out. You continued steadily, right?
Oh, yeah.
So that's interesting. We dropped out mainly, you know, the kids got disinterested and we got interested in some other things. And I remembered after the black belt, I noticed there was a shift and I was looking for something. And I spoke to Sensei Harp, who was the main sensei, about this. And he suggested sword. So I started sword, and so did Kathleen, and I didn't like it. It wasn't doing it for me. And, you know, I thought a little bit about, well, you know, it's new, you have to stay with it. But it felt, I don't know, the phrase I'm going to use, this is just me, it felt more like cultural appropriation than practicing karate. It just didn't feel like me. What am I doing with a Japanese sword? Which I didn't have a real sword at the time anyways. So I spoke to Sensei Harp again, who said, I don't know any way to help you get what you want. This is all I know to offer. And that was really truthful. And it also stopped me. I mean, I just didn't pursue it anymore. And then, you know, decades later, I had two bad knees and God knows why I wanted to do this. I thought I would try to go back. And I thought I was going to go back and just do katas form, which I never really enjoyed, but I thought that's all I would do in my age and my orthopedic incapacities. And lo and behold, I got convinced. It wasn't in a general class. I was having private lessons with two young senseis, a man and a woman. And I just asked once, can I just spar a little bit, just once? And that was it. All I wanted to do was spar, and they beat the crap out of me. And I loved it. And then I just was hurting so much I couldn't continue. You had a steady interest in martial arts.
And yes, and as soon as I learned about the sword, I wanted to do it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me some more about that. How did you fall in love with the sword?
The first time I really, well, I saw the sword kata. Sensei Harp developed the kata for the sword himself. That was actually what he was assigned to do for his Minkyo test, which is equivalent to about the fourth degree black belt in the system at the time. And for him, it was very much a meditative art. You first learn Kenjutsu, where you're using a wooden sword and you're working with a partner and everything. So you learn how to use the thing. But then this is using a live blade. So it's meant to be a very mindful art, a slow art. It's a solitary art, or even if you're in a group, you're kind of doing it solo and very meditative. And he developed this kata, and he only did it publicly three times. The first time was to test it at a tournament that Heidi Ochai ran down in Binghamton when he first developed it, to see if it felt authentic to him, because he was really respected him as a martial artist. The second time was at Sensei Jennifer's black belt test, when there were several people from different martial arts, several senseis and sifus there. And it was, as usual for those tests, hot as blazes. So each of them did something during one of the breaks to give the testers time to cool off a little. And Sensei did that kata then. He would go in the dojo very early every morning and do it when no one else was around. No one was allowed to watch. You know, it was like, if you're here, stay out. Go somewhere else. Don't be in here. It was seriously a part of his spiritual practice. The third time was at a tournament that a friend of his, Kathy Faust, was running at St. John Fisher. And to support her, he did his kata in the weapons class. And I will never forget this, because there were six rings in this big gymnasium, and there were different things going on in each ring. One place there were katas going on, someplace else there's something else. And so Sensei started the kata, and the kata begins with you're kneeling in perfect stillness, and then draw the sword with a ki strike, and then go into the rest of the kata. I was sitting in the stands watching, and slowly every one of the rings, one by one, fell silent. And you could have heard a pin drop by the time the last ki happened. It was stunning. That whole sense of calm in the center of the storm was so powerful watching him. Sometime later, I asked him if he would ever do it in public again, and he said no. Partly because it was too distracting. It took too long for him to get the sound of the applause out of his ears. He didn't like that. I sort of worked at the dojo since I was an orange belt. So I kind of knew he was in there doing that. I had seen it once. And that whole, again, it was an incredible moving meditation. And so that whole thing appealed to me. I couldn't wait to get my black belt and be able to start studying that, because you had to be a black belt before you could study it. So that was one of the things I was really had as something I wanted to do from the time I was, I guess, an orange belt.
So you learned that kata?
I did. There are 12, I believe, short forms, combinations of movements, and then the kata, which is much longer and very sustained. And I loved it.
That's a very moving story.
We had a class, the sword class happened on Sunday mornings, very, very early. And again, there were only black belts in there. And so once everybody had learned it, we'd do it. Sensei would lead us through some things beforehand, and then we would do the combinations and the kata kind of on our own, even though we were in a group. It was a very large dojo, so we could do that. And afterwards, he would ask us questions about what had happened, and he would say stuff. And I wish I could quote. I didn't think to bring my notebook down with me, but I'm very familiar with spiritual literature, both Christian and Buddhist and other denominations. He would say stuff that came right out of the most profound spiritual literature. And I knew he hadn't read it. He was not a reader. He was a kinetic learner. So I knew he had not read it. He had sort of discovered it on his own through the Tai Chi kata that he did and the sword kata. And it infiltrated into everything else we did. And in martial arts. Over the years, I did notice that the people who didn't like kata in general tended not to like the inner development class or the sword.
It's interesting because my last contact with Sensei Harp was when I was trying to get back into it and I fell in love with sparring again. Mm-hmm. And he and I were sparring a little bit because he was recovering from an illness or something. Mm-hmm. And he stopped me and he said, "You meditate, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, I can't quote it exactly. He said, "Well, it doesn't show when you're sparring. Sparring is like meditation. Nothing should matter. You should just mm-hmm. do what comes, what needs to be done or what comes to you. You know, you're flinching when I do this and again." But mm-hmm. he just stopped me and he said, "Sparring is a meditation and you're not doing it, even though you're an experienced meditator." Once in my life when I sparred with him, I did hit him in the face and he was so surprised. It was the only time I ever did it that he didn't see it coming. I didn't telegraph it. I wish I knew what I had done or how I had done it. And then he beat the crap out of me. That one little experience of it's a moving meditation and you just get lost in the experience. And that's not something that I could master. Talk a little more about the inner development kata.
It's a kata that is based on Tai Chi. There's a long story behind that. When he was young and first in martial arts, after he, you know, racked up a score of trophies and had been on the cover of Black Belt magazine and a couple of others, he started searching because that wasn't enough. I mean, winning trophies was very boring after a while. And he was, as I said, on a spiritual search. There was a guy in town at the time. He wrote a lot of articles for Black Belt magazine. He was well known nationally. There were three things that were for Sensei very significant. For one of the articles, he introduced him to Henry Valaire, who was the head of the Kazuyarashi Ryu system, which was Aikijujutsu and Kenjutsu, both of which are ancient Japanese arts that have nothing to do with karate. And Aikijujutsu is the ancestor of Aikido. If any of you are familiar with that, it's an art where you redirect an attacker's energy into a throw, a control, or a joint lock. And so an itty bitty person can just take a great big attacker and kind of whip them around and, you know, they're flying through the air. It's quite spectacular to look at. It's actually quite beautiful too. All involves circular movements. So it can be done again in a very flowing and beautiful way. So he got involved with that. This guy had also taught him Tai Chi. Now, he would often go off to seminars and come back having learned an art. And so Sensei Harp learned this Tai Chi form. And at one point, he also knew Mackenzie Stewart, who was the founder of the Rochester Tai Chi Center. And he showed him the form. And Max said, "Well, that's really good, but it doesn't relate to any Tai Chi style I know." So he had two choices at that point. He could chuck it out saying this is all a fake, or he could take it and work with it with the principles of Tai Chi that he knew and still use it. And that is what he did. So he really made it his own and used, again, he had studied a great deal of the principles of Tai Chi with Mac and other people. And so he practiced it and developed it on his own and made it into this magnificent mind-body meditation. He started teaching me that when I was a brown belt. And I can remember, he took me out on the dojo floor and said, "Now, this is one of the three things that really made me the martial artist I am." Well, that's all he needed to say, and I was ready to learn it. And again, it's one of those things that is very mind-body because the way we do it is actually a lot slower than a lot of Tai Chi is practiced. You have to be very aware every moment of everything you're doing. That's the whole goal of it. It was the core of what later became the inner development class that he started and then I continued teaching. And people would say after that class, they would go outside and all the colors would be more vivid and they became more sensitive to energy. They could hear and notice things much more. When we would go outside and practice it, it's really at first very strange because you're this little bitty person. And instead of filling a room with your energy, you've got this, you know, the universe. But it was a way of kind of plugging into the universe, and people would feel the same thing after that. It's also highly portable. You can do it almost anywhere. It was a major piece of my development as a martial artist, following in his footsteps. And I actually taught it to some people who hadn't studied martial arts, And they also found it beneficial, as with many of the other things we did. That program also involved stretching and body scanning, again, not as a way to get your nose to your knees, or you weren't focusing on flexibility, you were focusing on just stretching to the point where you could feel the pull and becoming aware of the muscle that way. So if you went through this class and continued practicing it, you could become aware of when you're doing movements, what muscle initiates the movement and how does it continue and where is the energy flowing? And we would notice things like we could discover we were coming down with a cold 2 or 3 days before we showed symptoms because our balance and our energy would feel a little bit off. So it was an amazing mind-body awareness thing. The sword added to that because, first of all, you're extending that energy by a good bit. It's amazing what having a live blade that could cut your thumb off will do for your mindfulness.
Good point.
That was not an art you wanted to practice if you were distracted and you were highly motivated to stay in the moment.
Right. So you started off, you said when you took up karate, you were already involved in organized spirituality. I mean, it sounds like you've always been we should probably talk about a definition for you of what spirituality is, but you've always been aware of that and interested in that, and then got involved in an organized way, added the martial arts. How did that affect your, again, for the purposes of discussion, your spiritual life or your view of spirituality?
Oh, it had a profound impact. And yet, my view of spirituality was formed in a very articulate way when I was about 12 or 13. I was bicycling over to the Great Neck Library, and you passed over this very low bridge on a pond where there was an old flour mill with a wheel, and it was surrounded by trees. And it was just really pretty. So I stopped my bike and climbed down, and sat there for a minute, and it was in the fall. And as I sat there, there was a moment, all of a sudden, when everything became luminous. And I had this profound sense of being more vast than myself, and at the same time, a sense of a really vast presence with me. That lasted for a few moments, and then it faded away. It was only later that I looked back and realized that was what I would describe as the presence of God. And that became the touchstone for everything. And for some time, it ran parallel to my experiences in the church, various churches, as I was growing up. But that was the thing I was always in search of without necessarily articulating it, how to, first of all, understand that and then recontact that again. I found it often hit me at times I was really not expecting, and it would not normally be considered terribly conducive, walking through the student union at RIT at one point up the stairs. Walking across the dojo floor when I just finished vacuuming the dojo, I wasn't doing anything. I started being interested in meditation and spirituality from a Christian perspective. While I was in grad school, I started reading things like the works of Thomas Merton. I had read some Christian mystics when I was in high school and started doing things like just sitting quietly in the church when there was no one there and stuff like that. And I found that that was also a way to access this. And then in the martial arts, I found that it was a way to access this. And so they all worked together to really help me to approach and begin to learn to abide in that. And I'll talk more about that when we talk next time about spirituality and organized religion. But the other thing that really helped it was Dzogchen meditation. And a variant of the loving kindness meditation that Lama John McCransky developed, which was one of the 3 or 4 most powerful influences on me, ultimately.
So it sounds like with the martial arts, it really provided an experience in and through your body.
Yes, it really helped me incarnate that. And of course, anybody who meditates knows the body can be a huge influence. Just breathing, learning to breathe. We have a couple of breathing katas. They're in the several of the sword forms involve specific breathing forms. The Tai Chi involves breathing. Realizing how much the body can be a locus and a support for spirituality came through the martial arts. being out in the woods, you know, I had gotten already, but this was where I really learned how much the body and the mind work as one, and the spirit work as one, that they're not disparate pieces, that they all co-inhere.
So when we were talking about doing this podcast, you know, originally the idea had been talking about the spirituality of martial arts. And then the obvious came up, which is you're a woman.
Yeah.
And you pointed out how for you as a woman in the martial arts, you didn't find any difficulty. Other women that you knew did, but you didn't.
Yeah.
And when we've talked in other podcasts and in some of our classes on Amberlite, we've often talked about the experience of the feminine, the experience of women getting more and more involved, is allowing for a reemergence of connecting with the body and connecting with nature, things that yes. especially organized religions in the West have tended to cut. You know, the nature is bad and it's evil and it's pagan mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it. And there's only an interest in that transcendent experience you experienced as a preteen. But admitting the experience through the body and not only being aware of it, but welcoming it and fostering it, that's a new reemergence that's coming. But then you said this really provocative thing, which was that not only did the martial arts allow for that, and then allowed for women to become more confident in using their body and, mm-hmm. and being more confident in the world. You also said that it allowed women to start taking different roles in society than what was usually expected. That's really striking to me. The influence that martial arts have on women and their experience psychologically and also spiritually, but also the effect in our greater society of what that has allowed women to do. So could you speak about all of that?
Whoa, okay. Let me go back to a second to the spirituality element of the dojo, because I think that was a big piece of it. It was always hospitable to women. While I was the first woman in the dojo to get a black belt in all of the arts we taught, I was not the first woman to get a black belt. There were several women before me. And I think there was a balance of yin and yang in that dojo that was rare at the time, and I think still is, where the outward, the assertive, the strong, in that sense, very yang stuff. And at the same time, I can remember Sensei Valera one time, where, as we started to practice, say, accept the attack and then redirect it so that the person just gently finds themselves flying through the air. So it allowed for different kinds of strength. And women were in teaching roles. Women were up there as the assistant to the head of the school. That confidence allows you to not have to sock somebody in the face when they challenge you or threaten you. You're free to choose your responses. You also know how to take a position. You know, a lot of times, one of the things in the self-defense class, especially with the younger women, in the early years, we had to deal with was that whole sense of we're not allowed to take up space. We're not allowed, we're in charge of how everybody feels. So if you say like somebody is pushing you, you kind of go, no, no. And you smile. So they know you're still taking care of them. You're a nice person. As opposed to just saying, is there a problem taking that space? And all of those were skills that I personally learned at the dojo, which have helped me in all kinds of other situations. I can recall at one point being in Brugger's, and this guy came in, was clearly either on something bad or out of his mind. He was ranting and raving and just, and you know, everybody kind of like disappeared from around him. He sat over at a table not too far from me, and I'm quietly finishing my lunch. And I thought about staying for coffee, but I decided I didn't want to be bothered. Because if I had to cross in his line of vision, I was probably going to have to interact with him. I wasn't afraid of him. I didn't want to be bothered, which is really different.
Right. So you're right about the dojo. My experience, I can't remember registering surprise at the women in the dojo. Maybe I would say something like, or think something like, wow, I can't believe she can kick like that. And there would be that implication of she's a woman and look at what she can do. But some of my most memorable teachers were, well, you were one as a woman, and I know people on the call and who are listening are not going to know the names, but Sensei Jennifer had a kick that was like, oh my goodness.
Pile driver kick.
Yeah, it was amazing. And
you would regularly see people flying through the air.
Yeah, just about.
And you just knew. You didn't even have to ask.
Yeah,
you knew.
Kathleen was one of them. She actually flew through the air, right. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, and I had tried to come back after my injuries, and it was much later in life, I was sparring with Sensei Lee, who... Right. It was really interesting. I used to joke about this, but it's true. My idea of sparring is to be like Joe Frazier in boxing. Close, and I try to beat the crap out of you. And Sensei Harp would always say, look, you have to learn how to kick, and I just can't do that. And I'm a brawler. And I wish I could be like Muhammad Ali in the martial arts, but that wasn't me. So I would get in really close with her. I mean, really, we were just, you know, nose to nose. And she could still kick me in the gut. And I just would look at her and say, how do you do that? And she would just say, I don't know. She did know. She just was amazingly flexible. And
She and Jennifer could chamber that leg
It was amazing how powerful it was. Mm-hmm. And then she said this interesting thing to me. She clearly liked sparring with me, and I liked sparring with her. And she said to me, you know why I like sparring with you? Because I am really afraid sparring close like you spar. Most people who spar are doing it from a distance, and they try to kick, and you come in close and you don't let me get away. And I need to learn how to deal with that, because mm-hmm. that scares me. I mean, she was regularly beating the crap out of me, but I learned something from that about her as a person, mm-hmm. and how she was pushing the limits that she was learning too, and what it was doing for her. Mm-hmm. So I think from the beginning, I appreciated the mix and just took it as very natural. Some of the outstanding mentors that I had were women.
Yeah.
And I would emulate. I would look up to them and try to emulate them. Mm-hmm. So that you're right. I never studied at another school, so I don't know. So maybe it was something. I think
it was pretty unique.
It was unique to that dojo.
Yeah. Three or four of us, the only one of whom you know is Sensei Julie, were invited to go to a weekend kind of like seminar thing for women in martial arts. And we were all staying in a hotel somewhere. I even forget where it was. But we were stunned because everybody else there was talking about what a rough time they had, how, you know, they were held back for promotions and everybody was beating the crap out of them to intimidate them and this and the other. And we're like, what planet is this? At the time, our dojo was very unique. First of all, you were not in competition with anybody but yourself. And you didn't have to be able to beat up three orange belts to get your yellow belt. You had to improve. So we once had a student who came in who literally couldn't pick up a foot without falling over. At one point, one of the black belts walks through the dojo and Sensei Harp is just sitting there like this. And she said, what happened? He said, this new kid, she's going to kill herself. She turned into Sensei Jennifer, this incredible martial artist tournament champion. And, on the other hand, we had people come in who could, you know, leap high and be very coordinated. Well, they had to practically be able to walk tall buildings before they got their yellow belt. We measured you against what your potential was. So it's also a good school for people who are disabled in some way. We had a young man who had brain damage who actually was able to get his black belt, for example. Sensei Harp taught Aikido Jiu-Jitsu to students from the Association for the Blind. We taught both karate and Aikido at the Norman Howard School. The way we taught, you know, again, it was you. We also taught kids from Camp Good Days. It's you you're competing with and no one else. Okay. And sparring was kind of that way too, ideally. Sparring was a wonderful way to learn mindfulness and learn about yourself. Again, if you remember when I said when I was first starting, and this was true through most of the years I was there, actually, most of the people I sparred with were younger, faster, and probably stronger than I was, and certainly taller. There were very few students in the school my height or lower. So if I got all hung up over, oh my God, I got hit, that invalidates me as a martial artist. Or I got to get this guy. I would find not only would I not enjoy it, but I would lose. So I very quickly learned to monitor my own responses, because it was about that more than it was about what the other person did. And I learned to read people so I could tell what they were doing pretty much as they were forming the idea. But I also learned that I needed to be curious. Okay, if this person fights like this, what's going to happen if I do this? And to detach myself from my ego's desire to be better, to win, or to score a point. Because if I fell into that, I invariably messed up, and also it wasn't fun anymore. So I even went, we wore sparring gloves to protect each other. But within the gloves, instead of handing my hands and fists, I'd have them loose like this. So I could monitor. As soon as they tightened into fists, I knew that meant I was getting tense. And I would consciously relax, breathe, and just be curious about what happened. The consequence was I usually did not lose.
No, I don't.
But that was not the goal.
Right. Talk a little bit, if you will, about opening up even more to the transcendent, because we talked about that as well. That experience you had as a young girl of riding your bike and having those few moments of a mystical experience. When we were talking, you said the other thing the martial arts does is it not only brings it in through your body, but it opens you up to those kinds of experiences as well.
Certain of the arts actively cultivated that. So the Tai Chi Kata, the inner development class, that whole ball of wax, and then the sword opened you up to that. Partly again, because you learn to detach your ego from what you were doing. You were learning mindfulness, not by sitting, but by moving. In the sword art, there's also a piece of it which involves just sitting in seiza, which is kneeling, very quietly, and then from nowhere drawing your sword. And if you could really do it from nowhere, you had a perfect draw. I mean, it would just fly out like one of those magical swords that would do the fighting for you in the fairy tales. Whereas if I thought, okay, now I'm going to draw the sword, it would invariably be more work, more of a struggle. It didn't have that magical smoothness. In the course of learning that and practicing it, I would find myself before, during, and after being in that place. And many times, the kata, the Tai Chi kata, the sword kata, both end in seiza, and you just kind of stay there as long as you want to in meditation and in stillness. And I would find, again, the body and the breath and the mind were all one, and I was being in that stillness, and suddenly I was there, but there's no there, you know what I mean? I was in that moment, in that contact again. Right. And I realized it was not separate from me, but there I was.
Right. I don't know if you're going to remember this. I think I was a brown belt and I was studying for my black belt test. And I know you were teaching the class and you asked me to do the brown belt kata, the name I can't even remember. I'm embarrassed.
But oh, Suwonsu?
Probably. It's relatively long. The kata.
Oh, that's Suwonsu.
So it was me doing it, and you know the class was standing at attention, and you were the teacher. And the only time this happened to me, as soon as I started the kata, I knew something was different. I had this little voice in my head saying, "Oh, there's something different," and it flowed. My balance was perfect, which was really hard for me. I was barely aware of you watching. All I was aware of is that it was flowing and it was really powerful and it didn't feel like me. But I knew it was me that was, my body was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I ended it, I knew it was different. And just as I was wondering, wow, I wonder if anybody else would ever notice that, you said something that was a little different. Basically, you said, good job. It was the way you said it. I knew that you knew. And I never talked to you about it. But I knew it. And, you know, if I could have had more experiences like that or stayed with it longer, maybe it would have. But I still remember, you know, there are times when I've done a spiritual practice. So Sufis do a lot of zikr. It's like mantra. And I've had experiences where I'm doing it out loud and then all of a sudden it's not me.
Yeah.
And I know it's me, but it doesn't sound like me. I'm not consciously doing it anymore. It's just happening through me.
Mm-hmm.
This was very similar in a martial art.
You know it when it happens. It's like, and for me, that's it. That's what I was looking for. That's what I wanted to find.
Right.
Yeah. And you know it, and it's visible. People may not consciously know what's going on unless they themselves have experienced it, but boy, they can see it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure people know they can ask questions. I don't know if anyone has sent in a question on chat. Elaine?
A couple days ago, I actually watched a informational documentary filming various Zen Buddhist, I don't know the proper terminology, temples, teachers, and practices and students in throughout various temples in Japan. And the purpose was to elucidate the practice. I'm bringing it up because one of the pieces, a very short piece of it, there was a gentleman, master sword person, and he did, I don't even want to say the word performed because that doesn't feel appropriate. They filmed him just doing kind of what looked to be the beginning of a practice. It was within the context of this Zen video. So that's my first question. Is this associated, your sword practice that you practice, associated with Zen Buddhism? Number one. Number two, very briefly, or are there symbolic meanings for the sword? For example, the what it's made of, the fact of its sharpness, and the sense of it as a weapon in any way, spiritually, culturally?
Let me answer the first question first, and then if I don't answer the second one, repoint me, okay? After they connect, Zen has a profound influence on Japanese martial arts. With the exception of ninjutsu, which is more influenced by Shingon Buddhism, which is similar to Tibetan Buddhism. But the Japanese samurai pursued Zen for a number of reasons, religious, cultural, the whole culture was infused with Zen. And also because as a samurai back in the day, you were prepared to give your life for your overlord at any moment. So you had to be prepared to die at any moment, which meant you needed to deal with that, because a lot of them did. And Zen was therefore something that was very appealing to samurai culture. And it had a massive influence on the whole Japanese aesthetic. Everything Japanese just about is saturated in Zen, directly or indirectly. Karate actually originated on Okinawa as more of a peasant's art. And for people who were deprived of the ability to use weapons. So directly, it has less of a Zen influence. But as it's practiced in many places, and certainly in our dojo, the Zen influence was huge. I want to make a distinction. Zen, not necessarily Zen Buddhism. Because like many things, many of the values of Zen and the approaches of Zen can be removed from the religious context. And Zen practitioners, as many some Buddhist practitioners, will say that. Zen is not specifically Buddhism. It is part of Buddhism, but Zen isn't Buddhism. And, you know, and they'll you do these little paradoxes. Emptiness, the notion of emptiness, the circle, is very much a part, particularly, again, of the sword arts. And that very much came down to us. Our manual, our student manual, had a number of Zen stories. Pay attention to the spaces between the techniques. Emptiness, openness, you know, the old Zen master who's greeted by the student who knows everything and who, as a student, is showing off, starts pouring the tea until his cup totally overflows. And the guy goes, stop. So what are you doing? And he says, well, you know, you can't pour anything into a full cup without it spilling. So all of those influences were very much there. And I would say in any of the Japanese martial arts that are somewhat internally inflected, they are there, definitely. Karate can be practiced either way, and in our case was very Zen. Symbolism about the sword. Swords throughout all cultures have some symbolisms. You know, the mystical sword that Arthur drew from the stone, the sword Excalibur that the owner could not be defeated, that had to be given back to the lake when he died. Various Norse legends about swords that would magically guide you. So swords have always had kind of a mystical aspect, as well as the general bloody aspect of cutting the opponent to pieces. Smiths who forged Japanese swords, it was very much a Shinto religious ritual. They wore white robes like the Shinto priests did. They meditated before and even during the forging. The sharpness of the sword, again, could be that sword that cuts through illusion. Some in Vajrayana, there are, in Tibetan Buddhism, there are notions of a sword cutting through illusion. There's the purba that is also symbolic of cutting in that way. So it did have that kind of connotation. It merges the elements. Earth, steel, fire, air, metal, all are merged in the making of this sword. There were swords with personalities, in a way, not like they'd talk to you and say, hey, let's go get coffee. But there were certain swords, for example, historically, that were considered unlucky, or smiths whose swords were considered unlucky. And there were others who were treasured because their smiths were considered profoundly spiritual and beneficial. We had one black belt who really was into this stuff. And oh, my Lord, you know, if he was here, he could go on for hours about this. For us, because this sharpness of the sword, again, had that cutting through quality, as well as the mind sheer utility of you're going to be mindful or you'll hurt yourself. But there was that, again, cutting through was very much a spiritual thing. When we got our sword, all of us were supposed to be using live blades. We were told to get our swords blessed by a priest, a shifu, a rabbi, or whoever. And we did. And we gave our swords a name that was meaningful to us, which we did not share. So there was that same quality. Again, the sword was very much, you didn't show it to people. I wouldn't have people come into my house and pull out my sword and say, oh, look at this cool blade. So it was very much treated as a sacramental, with a small s, object. An object that was for the purpose of spiritual practice. Does that help?
Thank you so much for sharing.
Joyce, you had a question?
I used to be really athletic, and I did start a bunch of martial arts. I started Kung Fu, Aikido, Tai Chi, and I spent time living in a Korean Zen center. But I didn't keep going with anything. I got pregnant during Aikido, and I also, with Kung Fu, the idea was it was going to help me be spiritual, but I mean, it was just really hard, and I had these guys really trying to hit me, and I was like, what am I doing here? Then the Tai Chi was nice, but it was slow, and I kind of wanted more, you know, I used to be really athletic. So these ideas would make me not continue. But anyway, I'm almost 70 now, and I'm just wondering if I should try to get back into something and if it would be beneficial. And, you know, I guess it would have to be Tai Chi because of my age. But if so, which Tai Chi form is the best? And maybe if there's another one that would be good, or maybe I shouldn't do any of these things. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
I do. Let me ask you first, what is your current practice?
I do prayer. I do visualization. I can get myself peaceful if I'm in fear and turning to the source, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that helps. I would say, first of all, in terms of physical limits, some of it just depends on your own body. I'm not particularly interested in sparring anymore, partly because I'm slower than I used to be. I'm 75. I just took up horseback riding this year. So I don't think these things necessarily. And we had a woman in her 70s who got a black belt in karate and was taking Aiki. I think, though, there are two answers to that question. One is I would suggest Tai Chi or Qigong because they are slower. The second thing is you usually have to master the physical stuff before you can get into the spiritual stuff. And that's a problem. I mean, I was a brown belt before Sensei Harp taught me the Tai Chi Kata. I'm using that firm in quotes, Tai Chi Kata.
What is kata? Is that just the
form? That's a form. Okay, form. It's a series of movements, almost like a dance. It can be very brisk or very flowing, depending on what it is. But it's a form that is, in summary, kind of like a mock battle that one person is doing
a
lot.
I did learn a 40 form in Tai Chi when I took it.
Well, there are a lot of different forms.
Okay.
I think what I would do is I've been out of contact with Tai Chi practitioners. But I would check with the various people who are teaching it. First of all, I look on their websites and see what they talk about as their purpose and goal. We had a library in the dojo stocked full of all kinds of books, including a number of books on Tai Chi that focused on the principles and the spiritual part of it. So for with Henry's experience, for example, before he could do that, have that experience, he had to have learned the basic techniques, which is, well, it can be boring, unless you're doing stuff with your mind while you're doing it to make it not boring. Then he had to learn the kata, the form itself. Okay, here's the movement, do it this way, do it that way, here's how you balance, and what you're doing while you're balancing it, so you don't do something that looks pretty but is stupid. And then, after practicing that hundreds of times, he was in a point where that could happen. And in his case, he wasn't actively looking for it. There are things you can do if you're actively looking for it that will help encourage it to happen. But there is the basic grunt work. It's just like starting out Zen by learning how to sit cross-legged without dying, and that nobody perished of having their legs hurt. And then counting your breath. Isn't that boring? Oh, boring. Yes, noticing boring. And all of that stuff. So there is that basic grunt work to any practice. It's unavoidable. So the other thing is, I would find an instructor that talks a little bit about the spiritual or mind-body benefits of Tai Chi or Qigong. Try out a couple of classes to see if the atmosphere in the place is conducive. You know, if the person comes in and is barking orders at everybody, and obviously the almost exalted high, you want to avoid them like the plague. All the same stuff they say about looking for a guru or any kind of teacher. Once you've done that, you have to stick with the practice and you have to learn the techniques. And then when it gets to where you don't have to think about what you're doing anymore, you're ready to start the spiritual part. So yeah, part of it is hanging in there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This has been a joy. I hope you had as much fun as I did. It's really
Thank you. It's been great for me. I hope it's been helpful for others here.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.